the Bush administration. Could happen, but there's one difference, and I want to get to that. By the way, Madeline, give me a moment. Where are you? When did I start?
Oh, you've got 10 or 15 minutes.
I've got what?
10 or 15 before questions.
Uh-oh, okay. Not much left. All right, I'll jump ahead here then. Nixon was facing a Democrat House and Senate. And it wasn't a Democratic House and Senate like the present one or with the present leadership. It was a liberal, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as Dean put it, Howard Dean put it. It was a political environment which was very different from Nixon. But more to the point on this point, he faced impeachment from the House, which is very difficult. Well, it's impossible to imagine from a Republican House. And a Republican Senate, I'm sorry, a Democratic Senate seems less out of reach in a way. They can't impeach, but they can investigate and investigate things other than or in addition to the leak of the secret prisons, for example. They can investigate who got us into this war, the forgery, the torture, the prisons themselves, and so forth, the other things that are condemning Iraqis to hell, and many Americans to death, many to come, and our country to intense shame. For those of you who are patriots, as I am, and I'm sure this room is filled with them, you know that we have occasion to be ashamed of what is being done in our name, ashamed of the fact that we have a president and I would certainly be, I do not believe I would be an iota less ashamed of my president if he were a Democrat in the position of threatening to veto a bill because it banned cruel, unusual, and degrading punishment, or a vice president who was lobbying in that respect. This is a terrible situation and means, by the way, that we have to get a Democratic Senate, and if possible, and I'm just reading now the very first possibility that there could, some pollsters, including Republicans, are imagining a Democratic House in 2006. That will not come easily, obviously. But you know, months ago, it would have seemed quite incredible. After Katrina, after the failure of the White House plumbers and the demonstration on Katrina, after the increasing evidence of the lies on Iraq and the continuing lies about our victory policy, I think it was yesterday that the president here, let's see here, he had a, yeah, here was the poster behind, the banner behind the president yesterday when he spoke. It was not mission accomplished, that's gone by the way, it was strategy for victory. Now, did he lay out a strategy for victory? I don't think so. There is no strategy for victory in Vietnam. There was no possibility of a strategy in victory in Vietnam, although many people think there was, that if we bombed enough and so forth, the other side would have quit. I did not believe that. I don't believe that today. We can't prove it. I do not believe that the other side is going to quit their resistance to an American occupation in Iraq ever, and that the killing and dying by Americans is going to continue as long as we're there, and I'm afraid that's a long time. It means that getting a Democratic Senate and House is not enough, though it's essential, it's necessary. It's certainly not sufficient for getting us out of Vietnam, out of Iraq, when we have Democratic leaders like Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton who are calling for more troops in Iraq right now. They've got to be gotten off that line. Kerry, I noticed, did get off that line eventually, a little late here, but a couple of weeks ago split from them on the notion that we should reduce there. Changing the composition of Congress is essential. To that, and as I say, changing the composition or the stance of our leaders in the Democratic Party is essential. Feingold's position of getting out, totally out of Iraq by the end of next year is far better. I would be happy if it were sooner. But let me be frank here. I'm not here just to inspire with illusions here. I think it will be a long time before we get out of Iraq, very long, with Democrats or Republicans. And that Democratic leaders, the Democratic base, the people here would be glad to see us out, as I would soon, yesterday, tomorrow, very soon. And that would be for the interests of the United States. That does not mean that we're going to get Democratic leaders who are going to give up those bases in Iraq, in the midst of the oil fields there next to Israel. It's going to be a long time, which means a long struggle. We can't give up on that. But there are some things facing us, actually, that are more immediate than the question of whether we get out of Iraq or not in the short run. Here's another piece of information that just came yesterday. A guy named Douglas Thompson, who writes a column called Capital Blue on the internet, which I follow, says, a confidential memo circulating among senior Republican leaders suggests, back up 1 minute, it's obvious that in the last month we've had more good news about the vulnerability, the expose of the administration than we've had for a very long time, more than we could have expected to get, perhaps, ever. More indications of weakness and the possibility that real work will be repaid this time by changing the gang in Washington. But there is something that can save them from that in a certain way. And here's what the memo circulating among senior Republican leaders suggests: that a new attack by terrorists on U.S. soil could reverse the sagging fortunes of President Bush as well as the GOP and, quote, restore his image as a leader of the American people. It doesn't say he should do it. It says this is, you know, there's reason for hope here, or let's just say there's reason to think that the present low ebb could reverse. And that is, I'm sorry to say, true. That's not just the kind of nonsense that some Republican officials convinced themselves of, that we would be greeted with sweets and flowers if we went into Iraq. That was delusional. I wish it could say that thoughts like this are equally delusional. The closely guarded memo lays out a list of scenarios to bring the Republican Party back from the political brink, including a devastating attack by terrorists that could, quote, validate the president's war on terror and allow Bush, quote, to unite the country, end quote, in a time of national shock and sorrow. Now, there are those Republicans, says Thompson, writing this thing. This is on Capitol Blue, November 10th, on the web. There are people who say, well, there are dangers here. Again, let's be clear, nobody is in the memo or in the Republicans is saying, should we do this, should we not do this? They're saying, what would be the effect if this happened? And there are those who say, well, we have to face the fact, quote, that many Americans no longer trust the president as a longtime GOP strategist. That makes him harder for him to become a rallying point. And other Republicans worry that such a scenario might suggest the president has not done enough to protect the country. Yes, it might go that way. Let me give my own judgment. It's not likely to go that way. I think that in a time of fear and a sense of panic and crisis under these circumstances, the people will do what Americans and everyone else in every other country have always done, and that is to cling to authority, not only the authorities they have, but in particular to favor the ones who look tough and ruthless. A Putin in Russia, who is he doing the country any good by his massacres in Chechnya? No, but has it cost him points? Yeah, no, it's been the basis for his popularity there. I believe, and I'm sorry to say this as an American, I believe that one reason that Bush got as close to winning as he did in the last election, close enough to steal the election in Ohio, that the reason that was enough to push him over was that many Americans saw him as somebody who could be counted on if Americans died from a terrorist attack to kill some people. Counted on whoever it was. Didn't have to be the people who'd done it, those are impossible to find, as we've discovered, but killed somebody, whether they had anything to do with it or not. That he would not be bound by the Constitution, he would not be bound by laws, he would not be bound by the UN. No one, as he promised us, no one, no French, no people on the Security Council will veto what we're doing. They saw him as an outlaw, an out-of-control person. That's what we need in a time of danger. When I say that about Americans, let me be frank, I'm 74. I no longer see that as just a peculiarly American thing. What I'm saying is I no longer see Americans as all that different from other people in the world, and maybe I'll antagonize some people when I give the following analogy, but I found it very ominous when people responded to the second intifada, the use of terrorism by suicide bombers in Israel, where the peace movement and the Yesh Gvul and the out-and-out almost collapsed in the face of turning to Ariel Sharon, who by any tactic known to me, and I know a lot of people here may disagree with me in this audience, but I feel made their security worse by his actions in Jenin and elsewhere. And when I saw that happen, I said, that could happen over here. That could happen over here. And that's what did happen over here, I believe, and it could happen again. So let me, and I don't want to end on this note, but I feel to you people who are at the heart of our activist movement here, I want to lay out what I think very quickly is what we're facing. If, for good or bad, as the Republicans would say, if there is another terrorist attack, and obviously I'm putting aside the question of just whether the door might be opened for that, as was opened for the Reichstag fire. If there is another big terrorist attack, I believe that the president, this president, and I pray that it will not be under this president, but that's 3 years to go. He can't be impeached before 2007, and that would take a House, and I hope we get it, a Democratic House. But without that, if there's a terrorist attack, I think the president will get what he wants. And here's what I think he wants. This is my belief. I think he wants a new Patriot Act that has already been drafted, I feel sure, that will make this first Patriot Act look like the Bill of Rights. And the Bill of Rights will be a memory, and I hope it will be a memory, and I think we should start memorizing it right now. Second, military rule in parts of the country for which the president is already pointing to as the solution to the avian flu problem, if we need to quarantine, as the solution to later hurricanes. I think that will, he's preparing the country, I believe, to turn to the military and martial law, basically, in part of the country, if not all of it. Third, this may surprise you, a draft. Everybody knows that a draft is impossible and would be deadly for him this week or next week, despite the fact that all of our Democratic leaders, most of them, are saying we need, not all of them, we're saying we need more troops in Iraq, which we can't have without a draft. We can't keep sending people over for fourth tours, obviously true. To keep our troops there without sending them back again and again, you need a draft. And finally, we have people who are otherwise very good and very progressive, like Rangel, who are saying, and others, who are saying only a draft is fair. And the problem with that, he uses the word draft. That's unusual. He's for a draft, in part because he thinks that even contemplating the idea will hurt Bush. The problem is that after 9/11, Rangel will get his draft, and he won't like it because it will double the size of the armed forces in Iraq. In fact, triple them. No, if you're going to stay in Iraq, you can't do it with the size we have there now. There's two solutions. Get out or reduce the mission greatly. Go back right to the bases right now. Lower the casualties. That's not a long-term solution. But they're not about to do that. Or three, get more troops in there. And for that, you need a draft. And for a draft, you do need a terrorist incident. But if Osama bin Laden comes through for him again, then he'll get it. Then it'll be men and women. And the problem with Rangel's assessment is, yes, it will be more fair, and it will be a much larger armed force, and it will be engaged in shooting in Iraq and probably in Iran and Syria. Okay, fourth, if not earlier, an attack directly on Iran. which leaks have indicated there is plans already for possibly using nuclear weapons against their WMD underground storage sites and production facilities to demonstrate that we're willing and ready to do that. But even without nuclear weapons, a huge attack which would set the Middle East on fire altogether. Fifth, an Official Secrets Act, which we don't have yet, and in which case you'll see the difference. People will be, Judith Miller will be joined in front of grand juries and in jail by an awful lot of people every week for every leak, and not just for this specialized one. Leaks will become a thing of the past on the whole after some taste of that. There's a couple of other things. What I'm saying is I believe the next terrorist attack, unless we prepare, we in this room, in the ACLU, and other defenders of civil liberties, prepare for it right now, will be the effect the Reichstag fire was in February 27th, 1933, at which point a republic, a democratic republic, the Weimar Republic, changed virtually overnight. The first action taken was actually a decree by Hindenburg, who was still in office, for he died a couple months later. And Hindenburg, the president, put out a decree drafted by Hitler, nullifying the segments of the Constitution which guaranteed freedom of the press, freedom of association, privacy of mails, postal service, communication, associations, whatever, essentially their equivalent of the First Amendment, by decree, went the next day. We're facing, I think, that possibility. We have people who are prepared to do that and want to do it. And let me say, when I say this to people, most people of my own persuasion, the reaction I get past is usually, well, that could happen, that's possible. Just for the record, I'm saying, under those circumstances, it is my belief it is not just possible, but highly likely. Unless we're saying right now, an attack on Iran is not an acceptable reaction to a 9/11. An Official Secrets Act is not an acceptable answer. One thing I left out. Detentions, first of tens of thousands, next of hundreds of thousands or more of Middle Easterners, Muslims, and others at first, and their, quote, sympathizers. And there might be more than one non-Muslim sympathizer in this room who will be recognized by the president very quickly as a terrorist, as a sympathizer, on the grounds that we oppose the president's policy, like me. And people, I think, will be for the camps in that case. Say that happened overnight. I'm telling you, do you really disagree? I think that would be with the approval of most Americans, or at least half Americans. What would the other half be doing about it? What did they do about the Japanese, 120,000, when I was a kid, who went in, who presented no more of a threat, despite the plausibility, than the bulk of Middle Easterners in this country, the great mass of Middle Easterners. The Supreme Court upheld that at the time. This Supreme Court would uphold this now, without Alito, probably. Okay, what would we do? It is time right now to be saying we need a program for dealing with these measures, which for terrorists, which is a genuine threat, which does not involve destroying our liberties at home and changing our form of government. We need to hear that, and we're not hearing it. It's up to the people here to put that out. If this is going to be, if we are not to be living in a country like Germany after the Reichstag fire, then I think we have to be acting right now. This is a very serious challenge I'm putting here, and it's a very sober stuff. Obviously, to take this seriously, you don't have to agree with me on how likely this is. I think it would be very hard for you, if you think about it, to think that any one of the measures I've talked about is extremely unlikely under those circumstances. And it is interesting to see that the Republicans, according to this confidential memo, are already thinking that that could change their prospects of staying in power. And I think they are nothing but realistic when they say that. And if that should occur to anybody in the administration, that maybe the door could be opened for that some way. As Goering said, I set the Reichstag fire later. That's possible. And if anybody knows of such plans in the government, then my advice to them would be, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the war has started against Iran and Syria. Don't wait till the bombs are falling. Don't wait till thousands more people have died before you decide to go to the press and to Congress, not just to Congress alone. That was another mistake I made, waiting a year and a half for liberals in Congress to put this stuff out before I went to the press and lit a fire on them. And as I say, by the time I did it, I didn't have documents on a current administration. I'm sorry to say that I believe that with the information in my safe in 1964, 65, and the safes of scores of other people, the war, if I'd put that out at the time, there would have been no Vietnam War, period, in 64. Timing matters. Once the bombing had started, once the troops were over, in 1966, it would not have stopped the war. I still wish I'd done it, but it wouldn't have made the difference. I am saying now, I wish Richard Clark had told us in 2001 and 2002 what, to his credit, he did tell us in 2004, but it was late at that point. The war was well on. Mike Scheuer wrote a book, the pseudonym Anonymous, of CIA, who knew what was coming, knew that it was disastrous, and didn't tell us about it till it was well underway and had it cleared. Same as me earlier. I'm saying to these people, do what I wish I had done in 64, 65, and tell us the truth now. There are many Americans who could be doing that right now. It's not too late for Powell to start telling us some of what he needs. It's second best, but not too late for his chief of staff, Wilkerson, to be telling us now that this cabal manipulated us into war. What he knew, in other words, in 2001 and 2002, would have been good if he'd done it then. But there are further wars ahead, and there's a lot to go. One last thought here. I know I'm supposed to end and give some questions. I look at the paper today, and I see the sort of thing that is causing our popularity to go down. That is, I'm sorry, Bush's popularity to go down in the country. The Saturday Star Ledger headline, Four Soldiers Marine Become the Latest to Lose Lives in Iraq. And the inner headline, similar in the paper today, where is it? Well, anyway, that's the point. The latest to lose lives in Iraq, here it is. Four soldiers Marine added to casualties. How many people here see anything wrong with that headline? Anything wrong with the headline? What do you see? And one Marine, it's four soldiers and a Marine become. U.S. casualties. What it says is the latest to lose lives in Iraq. Were they the latest to lose lives in Iraq? What civilians, we move to the passive tense. What Iraqis lost their lives, let's not say who killed them, and in the action or the circumstances under which these Marines lost their lives. Latest to casualties. What was the headline last time you saw a headline or a story that gave you an estimate of the Iraqis who have lost their lives in this context? Never. Now, that's not just a government handout, that's our press. I'm sorry, there's somebody here from the Star Ledger today. Am I singling out the Star Ledger? Is it different in some other paper? Of course not. Now, the people here are capable of knowing. I remember I once sent Henry Kissinger into a very unwanted in a public meeting after I copied the Pentagon Papers, but before they'd come out. I had a chance to ask him a question at a public meeting, and the question was, what's your best estimate under your plans of the number of Vietnamese who will die in the next year of our operations. Knowing that they had estimates of the number of rubber tires we needed for our planes, the number of gallons of gasoline, and the number of U.S. casualties, threw him into a totally at a loss. He says, "You're trying to accuse us of racism." I said, "No, no, forget the Vietnamese. Just say, how many people will die in the next 12 years?" He says, "That is a very cleverly worded question." And I said, and then again, I said, "Well, it's not good. It's a simple question. What's your answer? What is your alternative?" I said, "You know, Mr. Kissinger, because I'd worked for him on options. I wrote his first paper for the National Security Conference on options in Vietnam. I said, Mr. Kissinger, I know the language of alternatives and options. I'm not asking that. I'm just asking, what is your estimate of the number of people who will die under your policy?" Any long pause, questioning, went around, paced around, had no answer. And the moderator ended, said, "Well, Dr. Kissinger has had enough questions tonight." And he left, having said earlier in the day, by the way, in that very same talk, somebody had asked him a question about something. He says, you're asking as though we were trying to widen the war. We are not widening the war. I tell you, we are winding down the war, and it will continue to wind down." This was in the spring of 1971. He left that night to go back to Washington and follow the pre-invasion bombing of Laos. The invasion of Laos took place 2 days later, after that talk. I'm saying we're looking right now at a widening of this war to Syria, it appears. It's happening right now. And to Iran. And it's up to us to do something about it. The reason not to do about it, to do anything, was given by U.S. Grant, General of the Union Armies, in Civil War and later president, and in his memoirs, I came across this passage, his attitude to the Mexican War. "I was bitterly opposed to the measure and to this day regard the war which resulted as one of the most unjust ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation." This is the Mexican War. "It was an instance of a republic following the bad example of European monarchies in not considering justice in their desire to acquire additional territory." Now, I read this, I studied up on the Mexican War and learned for the first time it was the clearest cut occasion of aggression in our history until this. So this is going on now. He was a second lieutenant, then a first lieutenant in that war from beginning to end. He said later, "I am ashamed that I did not resign my commission. I had not the moral courage to do so." And this was the part I wanted to get to. He said, "The presence of United States troops was not sufficient to provoke hostilities in the disputed territories. We were sent to provoke a fight, but it was essential that Mexico should commence it. It was very doubtful whether Congress would declare war. But if Mexico should attack our troops, the executive could announce, quote, whereas war exists by the acts of," that's exactly what did happen, denounced by very few people in Congress except for Abraham Lincoln, which limited him to 1 2-year term. He was sent back because he denounced it. "Once initiated, there would but few," this is Grant, there were but few public men who would have the courage to oppose it. Experience proves that the man who obstructs a war in which his nation is engaged, no matter whether right or wrong, occupies no enviable place in life or history. This is what Grant is saying he should have done, but he didn't. "Better for him individually, quote, to advocate war, pestilence, and famine than to act as obstructionist to a war already begun." And as I say, this stuff is very old. That goes back to, 1845 and so forth. And it's up to us. That's the situation we're in. If you're asking why the Democrats acting like cowards and passive, they don't want to be called names for the reason that Grant gives. They don't want to be called unpatriotic by an administration that uses that very promiscuously, very freely. They don't want to be called traitors, weak on communism, not communism, that was the old one, weak on terrorism, weak on Osama bin Laden, et cetera. Got to do it. When I was about to go on trial, I'm sorry, I was on trial. I've been on trial for almost 2 years. I was about to go on the stand after 4.5 months of trial. And we'd heard all the other witnesses, but the jury had to hear me, and they had to hear, believe me, rather than RAND officials who had committed perjury about what I had done. I wanted to say openly, frankly, with the facts of what I had done and explain why. They had lied directly about what I had done. The jury had to believe me. So one of my lawyers, Charlie Nesson, said to me just before I went on the stand, "Now, Dan, the main thing for you is to be calm, reasonable, steady, calm. Just remember, it all depends on you." And so that's what I'm telling you. It all depends on you. Thank you.